Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio. We are here until 5 a.m. It's Thursday, Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in, one artist, three songs, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. We're going to be talking about some Halloween stuff, some Halloween etiquette and Halloween candy. We're getting close to that day, so we'll talk a little bit about that and much more. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text if you would like to join us. Joining us right now for his biweekly visit is Dan Feinberg, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. Lots of TV to talk about. Let's welcome Dan back to the show. Hey, Dan, how you doing?
I'm doing good. How about you, Nick?
Not bad. Good to talk to you. Lots of TV to talk about.
And, as always.
Yep. So let me start by saying that I loved The Haunting of Hill House. I loved it.
This does not surprise me.
It was scary, and it was cool, and I thought it was great. I tore through it in 2 days, and I think it's one of the best things I've seen on Netflix this year for sure. I just thought it was great.
It's a very good show, and it does not surprise me at all that people are going nuts over it. I feel like I'm kind of, for whatever reason, in a minority camp wherein I think it's only very good.
Yeah.
and therefore I have to be like sort of, I have to be a little bit wet blankety, like, oh no, it's not great, even though it's a show I really, really like and gave a very positive review to. For me, it gets a little thin towards the end, mm-hmm. But it is wonderfully made. It's surprisingly resourceful for a TV show in a genre that TV does not typically do well, and it's acted fairly wonderfully across the board.
Yeah. I just thought it was great. I according to my social media feed, everybody watched it. So I guess it did really well. I would guess
it did. And I mean, without spoiling anything for the people who haven't. Listen, do you have a need or a desire after finishing it for a next installment?
No, not really. For me, it was a totally satisfactory tie up. I thought it was great. I'd be fine if it was a one season thing.
I am completely with you. There is no way that Netflix is going to let it be a one-season
no.
thing.
No, of course not.
too many people are talking about it too enthusiastically, and it is not the Netflix MO to allow anything good to just sit there and be good. They would rather bring things back and kind of destroy them, so they'd rather have a second season of 13 Reasons Why that no one required.
Right.
So, yeah, I am betting that there is going to be a second season of this, and there was nothing in the first season that, to my mind, justified or required following up on. This is a good 10-episode contained story. Walk away.
Yeah.
Wipe your hands, Netflix. Be happy. Be proud.
Yeah, but I'm sure the second season will be on its way. And it was, really just was... everything fell into place in terms of the quality of it, what it was based on, and the timing of them streaming it, when it became available, right around this time period. It was just everything about it was a perfect storm.
They know what they're doing, and honestly, if I were Netflix, I would say to Mike Flanagan, do you have another 10-episode family haunted house story that you want to tell or that you enjoy or that you think you have in you? I would say, what is your anthology version of this story, so that we're not attempting to bring back the Crane family and take them to another haunted house or the whatever. I would say, what is the other story you want to tell that's tangential to this, that's in this world but not featuring these characters in this house? Do that.
Yeah.
And I just don't imagine that that's something that Netflix is likely to
right.
to have the restraint
right.
to do.
Right. You reviewed it the last time we talked, and then you also reviewed a show that I have since started watching. And I got to tell you, Dan, I love camping. I love it. And there's not one character that's likable in it. Well, maybe Ione Skye, maybe, but she's, a head case as well. And Jennifer Garner's character is aggressively as you said, aggressively unlikable. And I love the show. The first two episodes, I think Juliette Lewis is incredible in it. I think everybody's really good at it, but I think Juliette Lewis is the standout. But you know what? I know you warned me about it, and you warned everybody about it. It's how much can you handle this lead character? She's enormously irritating. But I thought it was great.
I definitely think I laid the foundation for that show for you properly. And I would say that without any question, I agree that Juliette Lewis is utterly committed, probably in similar ways to how Jennifer Garner is utterly committed. Now, whether or not I think that it's quote-unquote good, and whether I think that Juliette Lewis is good is something else. Juliette Lewis played basically the same character in this week's episode of The Conners, so apparently this is just where her career has taken her at this moment, is that she's playing really, really annoying hippie flower children trying to be mature adults and failing. So I guess I'm glad that she is working, but you are in the minority on camping. I'm in the minority too. You know, be as tolerant of it as I am. The reviews of that show have been harsh, and the ratings were pretty awful. Yeah. So,
I'll enjoy it while it lasts. And I know in the feedback that I've gotten from other people who have watched it, they all think I'm nuts. Everybody thinks I'm nuts. It's not the first time I've been in the minority and liking a TV show that everybody else hates. But I don't know what it is. I think that David Tennant. I really just think everybody in it is so good. And you said committed. I think everybody is committed. David Tennant's hilarious in it. For some reason it rubs me the wrong way in the right way. If that's a possible thing to say, I don't know.
Possible to respect the show for how aggressively it's doing what it's doing. Now, the fact that, you know, even while respecting it myself, I didn't get any particular pleasure out of watching it doing what it's doing. And that's sort of where, for a lot of people, and I will watch the rest of the season, probably. So far, they've only shown the two that I watched. But the question of how long I can watch while being aggressively annoyed at everyone is a real question.
That is so true. It's absolutely so true. The second episode, Jennifer Garner with taking the kid to the hospital and everything was just like grinding my teeth, but I was loving every minute of it. It made me crazy, but I just enjoyed the hell out of it for some reason. But I could see somebody halfway through that episode going, "That's it, I'm done," and turning it off.
I suspect many people did that, but more people did that 5 minutes into the premiere, possibly.
Yeah, so, that's also true. speaking of HBO on Sundays, is anybody watching The Deuce, or am I the only person that's enjoying it?
I'm still four episodes behind on it. The answer is not all that many people, but it also doesn't matter because it's getting the one more season and that will be it. So I'm not hearing many people talking about it. At this point, it feels like the only people who are discussing it are my TV critic friends who write recaps of it for different publications. But it's possible that at this moment it could be a show that's only being watched by the recappers. On the other hand, that's kind of what a lot of David Simon's shows have ended up being in their first run, and people have just found them. So
that's true. I'm
looking forward to finding the time to catch up, and I just wish I knew that when that could come.
It's terrific, man. I think the second season is every bit as good as the first, and everybody in it is really terrific, and the writing is great, and It's David Simon, you know. I mean, put his name on anything, and I'll probably like it. That's the way it is. I always found it interesting to see how, you know, Dan, The Wire built. Like, because I started watching The Wire in 2002 when it first debuted, and I was on board from the beginning. But it was interesting to see how that really just climbed over the years and then exploded. And then people, you know, to this day, people saying it's one of the greatest TV shows of all time, which, in my opinion, it is the best TV show of all time. But it was interesting to see how that climbed.
I didn't watch it from the beginning. It began before I began doing this, basically, and before I had HBO. And so it was a show that I knew people loved. Also, I've always had a predisposition, not really against, but not to love cop shows. And in my mind, in 2002, that's what it was.
Yeah.
And I started catching up in season three. So I was a couple seasons behind, and I enjoyed quickly catching up with it, and that was great. But yeah, I unfortunately was not on board with The Wire, at least not immediately, and then I was.
And I am in the minority of the five seasons of The Wire. My favorite season is season two, and I seem to be the only one. But all that Sobotka stuff on the docks, all of that stuff to me so resonated, and that's my it's my favorite season. And people think I'm nuts because most people think that's the weakest season, but that's my favorite season.
Oh, I definitely don't think it's the weakest season. I am a strong advocate in favor of season two, and every once in a while someone on Twitter will say something ridiculous like, do I need to watch season two? And my reaction is usually somewhere in a high level of hostility. I think season two is a great season of television, and the fact that to my mind it's not better than seasons three or four is something else, and maybe not better than season one, but those are three of the greatest TV seasons of all time. It's definitely better than season five, and I think season five is very good. But
yeah,
anyone who tries saying that season two of The Wire is doesn't fit with the show, and you definitely hear people talk about that. You definitely hear people say, "Oh, it's like a totally different show." No, it isn't.
No, it isn't.
Like roughly the same show with us from a slightly different angle. Right? That feeds into the rest of the series. Come on.
Yeah, no, I agree. Well, anyway, I wish more people were watching The Deuce, but nobody watched Treme, right? That didn't do very well either.
And yep, no one watched Treme, and that was another one where it was sort of struggling along, and it ended up, I think, only getting a 5 or 6 episode final season, whatever it was a truncated closing season, and that's too bad also, because that was a show that got better with each season and that just got deeper and richer each part of the story they told. So, yeah, I don't even hear people talking about Treme, and that's a little sad and disappointing, because people definitely do talk about The Wire. There's no lack of respect for The Wire, but Treme is not a show that's ever in the here's a great TV show conversation, and I think that in the balance, that really was a great TV show that maybe didn't get the overall respect it should have.
I agree. All right, Dan, hang on, okay?
Sure.
All right, Dan Feinberg is with us, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. He joins us every other week to talk TV. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print. That's F-I-E-N. We'll take a break for the news, and we come back more TV talk with Dan after this. Back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. We're here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in now. One artist, three songs. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. Dan Feinberg joins us every 2 weeks to talk TV. He's here this morning. He's TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, and you can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And let's welcome Dan back to the show. Dan, welcome back.
Thank you much.
All right, you mentioned Juliette Lewis on The Conners. Now, I'm not watching The Conners because I was never a big, you know, Roseanne fan, and I think it's an incredible story that show exists. And that people are really enjoying it. Tell me what you think of it.
Some people are really enjoying it, and then there are the people who aren't watching it who are really hating it. Those people who aren't watching it, they really think The Conners is horrible. They have very strong opinions about a show that they aren't watching. It's always fun when I get to spend a weekend fending off conservative Twitter trolls, and definitely my review of The Conners caused me to have to spend a fun weekend doing that. The simple answer is that I think that the show still has the aspects of Roseanne that I liked best when I gave the premiere of last season a fairly positive review, and that would be John Goodman, that would be Laurie Metcalf, and that would be Sarah Gilbert. And I think those are all wonderful actors, both in general and in this format. I think that Roseanne was certainly the voice of the show. No one could deny that, but she was not a varied actress particularly. She did what she did, and that's what it was, but also she was, quite frankly, a distraction, and now the show just gets to accentuate and give more screen time to the actors who aren't her, and to me, it's a better, less distracting show for it. I was always hit and miss on Roseanne, and I don't know how often I'm going to watch The Conners this season, I think that the couple episodes that I've seen, and now they've both aired, so I'm as caught up as anyone else, were reasonably funny. They dealt with the quote-unquote departure of Roseanne, the character in specific, and basically her death, reasonably respectfully. They took no cheap pot shots at all at her, and given the circumstances under which Roseanne as a series was canceled, they showed much more respect for her in her absence than she showed for their jobs herself. So, yeah, I respect what they did and how they did it for the most part. The fact that the actors all had to kind of pseudo-semi-defend Roseanne, you know, that is what it is. They worked with her for however long they worked with her. They all owe their livelihoods to her. There would be no surprise that they would be appreciative of what she did for them in positive ways. And probably the side of her that they saw over the years was a different side for the most part. I don't think that The Conners is a great show, but I think that it's a decent show, and I think that it does show off a lot of very talented people and give them some room to shine. The premiere ratings were very solid. This week, the ratings went down a pretty fair amount. The question of whether they went down because it was on opposite Game 1 of the World Series is a real question. But I think even if the show were to stick somewhere in the vicinity of where this week's numbers were, it would be a success for ABC. And if it's not, basically, this was the season of Roseanne that they ordered, and the cast and crew got their paychecks. And they did not necessarily deserve to suffer because of Roseanne, and so they got that.
You know, I'm sure that one of the reasons why the ratings went down for the second episode is because I bet people were very, very curious to see how they were going to handle Roseanne's departure. I think that's probably even people who, because I was curious, and I didn't watch it, but it did pique my interest to see how they would handle it. But I didn't watch it. But I think a lot of people probably watched that first episode just because of that.
Oh, without any question, there was a train wreck, looky-loo, however you want to put it, audience for the first episode of The Conners, and that allowed it to basically do what Roseanne was doing ratings-wise at the end of last season. So it's still, it was never close to what Roseanne premiered at, and so a lot of one's favorite conservative publications ran stories comparing The Conners premiere to the spring's premiere of Roseanne, which is not how you look at TV ratings.
Right.
How you look at TV ratings is how the previous episode did. And the fact that it came back in line with how the Roseanne finale did in the summer, it was respectable, but it was largely due to curiosity about how they were going to handle it. And I think there was less of an audience for the second episode, but Roseanne Roseanne went down every single week in the spring. The ratings were dropping every week. So I assume that if it had come back as Roseanne, ratings for the premiere would not have been up. They would have not been flat. They probably would have been down, and they also would have continued to go down, probably not as steeply, but even still, they'd have gone down. It was where the ratings were trending, and it's how ratings work. So
right.
there's a lot of people cackling and being giddy about how the show has collapsed without Roseanne, and the reality is, A, it hasn't really collapsed, and B, it was collapsing a little bit with her as well. So I don't know. As usual in 2018, there are no real winners here. So yay.
Right. I do, you know, the three actors that you mentioned are three of my favorites. And I'm glad they're doing well on the show, because I think Goodman and Sarah Gilbertson and, of course, Laurie Metcalf is a national treasure as far as I'm concerned. So I'm glad that they're actually, you know, they're doing well on the show. So.
And Emma Kenney from Shameless, who was barely used last season. There's a little bit more screen time for her. Johnny Galecki and, as I mentioned, Julia Lewis were in this past week's episode. So there was a little bit of extra screen time for them. There's a little bit of extra room to breathe. And there's, you know, it's a big ensemble and a big ensemble of talented people. So there was no reason not to believe that giving everybody a little bit more work to do was really going to cause serious creative problems. It's roughly the same writing team. Bruce Helford, who ran the show last season, is running the show this season. So the people pretending that there's a large difference are just pretending, or they haven't really watched. And that's okay too. Whatever. We all like fighting about TV.
Well, in a similar vein, House of Cards is back, and without the main character. but is that doing well too?
In which way? Creatively or ratings?
Well, both.
No, we won't know.
creatively, basically.
Yes, it will premiere next Friday, and yeah, it's roughly the same situation in the sense that Netflix had ordered another season, and all of the Kevin Spacey sexual assault and sexual harassment news and allegations broke, and the show had no choice. They fired him and said, this is the last season now. And I think the truth is that this season was always going to be a season focused on Robin Wright's Claire. And so what they had to do was they had to adjust so that it was basically only about her. And I've seen five of the season's eight episodes, and I think the show is significantly better in Kevin Spacey's absence. But if you go back to what I've said and written about the show in the past, I thought Kevin Spacey was giving an awful performance on House of Cards anyway.
Mm.
So, in a purely creative sense, this was ideal. In a actual, you know, working behind the scenes, practical sense, this was clearly not ideal. This was a horrible thing that happened to this show, and a horrible conversation that many people need to have about what was ignored and enabled and abetted behind the scenes on House of Cards. But in terms of, does the show miss having Kevin Spacey being hammy in it? I think the answer is no. The problem is that because it's the last season, they're still tied to all of the plot lines that Frank Underwood, that Kevin Spacey's character, was attached to. And so they can't just pretend that those aren't happening, or they've chosen not to pretend that those things are happening. They could have done any number of things, but I think that probably would have involved them rewriting the entire season. So anytime that the show focuses on Robin Wright and on a couple of new additions played by Diane Lane and Greg Kinnear. They play a family of basically American oligarchs, industrialists with their fingers in a media empire who are beginning the process of encroaching on politics, basically. When it focuses on them, I think it's better than it's been since probably season two, but still half of the show is kind of cleaning up the Kevin Spacey, Frank Underwood mess, and that part of the show still doesn't interest me and still is pretty hacky. So it's very much a tale of two shows, but the fact that there is a half of House of Cards that is good this season, to me at least, is an improvement.
Mm-hmm. And has this ever happened before, two shows coming back without the main character? This has never happened.
It's certainly happened, sort of in isolation one at a time. The fact that these are two shows that had to handle different, horribly embarrassing crises involving their main defining characters, and that they've happened to premiere in a period of 3 weeks, that's a little unusual.
Yeah.
And that's a little sort of reflective of the cultural moment that we are in. The fact that we have to have these things lined up one next to the other, and that it's impossible not to compare them, makes it a little bit unique. Neither show per se misses their main character. Both shows had enough talented people to continue to go on and to continue to be good. The fact that Roseanne, after dealing with grief for an episode, gets to just become a sitcom that doesn't necessarily need to have serialized aspects, that makes it a much easier position that they're in, whereas House of Cards, as a heavily serialized drama, barring something like saying, okay, let's jump forward 4 years, it's now Claire Underwood's second term as president, and we're basically going to pretend that whatever happened in the last 4 years, she cleaned up every mess, and now she's starting anew. They could have done that, but that would have required another 6 months of basically rewriting the show, and I understand why they couldn't do that. It wasn't practical or sensible.
Right. Okay. All right, Dan, hang on, okay?
Sure.
All right, Dan Feinberg is with us, a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, and you can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. More TV to talk about right after we take this break on 720 WGN. All right, welcome back, everyone. It's Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studio here. It's Thursday, Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in now. One artist, three songs. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. Coming up at 5 o'clock, Steve Grzanich with the opening bell. At 6 o'clock is Steve Cockenworth, your morning drive. And coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. All right. It is our biweekly visit with Dan Feinberg, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, and you can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And we're talking TV. Let's bring Dan back. Dan, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right. So Nathan Fillion has yet another show, and it's called The Rookie, and it's on ABC. What are you thinking about that one?
I believe you probably just gave the people all that they need to know, that it is indeed a new Nathan Fillion show on ABC, airing in a 10 p.m. time slot. Tell your great aunts and your grandmothers. It's not entirely fair, because more than just grandparents love Nathan Fillion. First of all, I don't remember. Do you watch Big Mouth?
Yes, I do. Yes.
Okay, have you watched the second season?
No, I'm not. I have not.
It's so good.
Yeah, I love the first season, yeah.
You should watch the second season, too. It's so good. It's better. Not in like a quantum leap way, but in a... It's getting more and more sure of itself. I bring that up because Nathan Fillion is a character of animated erotic interest on Big Mouth, and specifically to a junior high school student, mm-hmm. thereby proving that Nathan Fillion is not only loved by older grandmothers and great aunts. Everyone loves Nathan Fillion.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Yeah.
Watch Big Mouth.
I will.
Don't worry about The Rookie, because it's at best mediocre. The plot is that Nathan Fillion plays a man who has a midlife crisis in the aftermath of a bank robbery that he's in attendance at, I guess, if you want to put it that way, decides to restart his life by moving out to Los Angeles and joining the LAPD, but it turns out that he's old. And that's the plot of the show. And that's what the show is. But it's exactly that. And there's something comforting about how exactly what you expect it to be the show is. And I think the show is in a little bit of denial about how old Nathan Fillion actually is or isn't. There are a lot of kind of 40-year-old virgin jokes in which it's suggested he's 40, even though that's not believable. But they never actually say he's 40, so they could just be making the jokes because it's an easy formulation. But yes, he does his Nathan Fillion thing. He says snarky stuff. The show is kind of all over the map because in addition to Nathan Fillion, there are a few other rookies who are starting at the same time, one of whom is in a relationship with the Nathan Fillion character, and there's a creepy age difference that the show doesn't want to deal with at all, and that's a little creepy. But it's okay, and that's about all. If you like watching Nathan Fillion do his thing, this is a very simple and convenient way to watch him do it. It's not a show I'm likely to watch. I've seen two episodes, and that's probably all I'm going to watch because, you know, there's just a lot of stuff on TV. And even though I watched every single episode of Castle, which is probably inexcusable in its own way, but I did. But, you know, I can't defend it, but I did watch every episode of Castle, so I guess that puts me down as a Nathan Fillion fan. You know, I watch all the episodes of Firefly, the movie, et cetera, et cetera. So I respect what Nathan Fillion can do. This show is not distinctive or interesting enough for me to give it more episodes, but I also completely understand why, for some people, it will become basically what Castle was, which is a fine show to have on while you're folding laundry, while you're making dinner, while you're whatever other things, you know, people do where they need something reliable on in the background. It's what Nathan Fillion's here for.
Okay. That's a great description of Nathan Fillion.
Hey, there's good money in being that person.
Yeah. There's no kidding. I mean, I think he's just, you know, incredibly charming, and there's a lot of residual love for, like, Firefly, I think, and things like that. I think the guy could probably have a TV series, you know, for the next 15 years, a different TV series every season if he needed it. So.
Oh, and one of these days, eventually, David Boreanaz and Nathan Fillion are going to have to team up in a show, and that'll be great. You know, it'll be the most comforting TV show ever because it'll basically be like everything you've watched on TV for the past 20 years, just in one show. The thing is, I'm trying to remember if Boreanaz at any point came back to Buffy in the season, in the closing season that Nathan Fillion was actually really fantastic in. He was all evil and dark and stuff, and I kind of wish he got the chance to do that more often.
Yeah,
I don't think they ever intersected, but surely some Buffy fan out there will be able to remind slash me. But yeah, one of these days, this is all culminating in a probably like 25 years down the road retirement home comedy. It's sort of like The Cool Kids, only it's more of a dramedy, and they're solving mysteries at the old age home. I think you can schedule that for CBS circa 2035.
Okay.
I'm there for it.
We're going to mark the tape. Dan, hang on, okay?
Sure.
Dan Feinberg is with us. We have to take a break here for the news, and when we come back, we'll talk more with Dan about TV. He writes for The Hollywood Reporter, and you can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. News is coming up right after this. All right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. Steve Cochran at 6. We're going to be talking about some Halloween stuff, Halloween etiquette, Halloween candy. We're getting close to the Spooktacular, which is going to be next Wednesday morning. So that'll be fun. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. And you can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page at facebook.com facebook.com/NickDShow. Dan Feinberg joins us every other week, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And joins us to talk TV. And let's bring Dan back. Dan, welcome back.
Thank you. I'm contacting my attorney to make sure that I get a commission on the David Boreanaz, Nathan Fillion retirement home solving crime things, because it's basically double Columbo, and I'm fairly sure there's money in that.
All right. There you go. I think you get it. Go ahead.
I didn't win Mega Millions this week, so I have to make my money somehow.
There you go. Well, so it seems to be a very witchy season. We've got the remake of Suspiria coming out in theaters in a couple of weeks. And we have two witch TV shows, which are reboots, coming back. Which one would you like? No pun intended. Which one would you like to start with?
And there are even three, because you're willfully ignoring the Vampire Diaries Originals spin-off Legacies, which is about a vampire werewolf witch hybrid and a school for extraordinary, supernaturally inflected young people who are vampires, witches, or werewolves. It just happens that one of them, who's the daughter of two main characters from the originals, is all three at once. They do indeed call her not a hybrid, but a tribrid. And yes, that is another show that exists. So that is three, and therefore it's a trend.
Yes. All right. Well, do you want to start with the which ones do you want to start with? Which one do you want to start with first?
I think probably because the CW's Charmed has premiered, people have a sense of what it is, which is just a sort of light, not particularly all that well made, but kind of amusing, very feminist update, reboot, revival, remake. It's really a remake of the classic witching show. And so I think people know how they feel about Charmed, whereas The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, and it's actually just Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, no the, that's the one that probably people are most interested in. And yeah, let's just say that this is not, in fact, your father or mother, Sabrina the Teenage Witch. Because it's not called that, and it is in no way like the colorful ABC Melissa Joan Hart sitcom of that name, which featured a lovable, snarky, talking cat named Salem, Carolyn Ray, Kraken Wise, and all of that. That is not what Chilling Adventures of Sabrina is. It is, to put it most easily, it's the Riverdale-ized version of Sabrina, and it is based on a comic that has also taken a very, very serious take on what really should be a fun premise. And at least for the first 5 of the 10 episodes that I've seen, which is the entirety of the second season, it takes a long time to become fun. In the interim, it's mostly very serious about the contractual negotiations that you would have to go through if you were a half-human, half-witch who had to decide whether or not she was going to sign her soul over to Satan.
What?
which is indeed a darker premise than you expect when you hear Sabrina the Teenage Witch.
Yeah, that's absolutely.
It is, and probably after episode 5 or 6, it starts becoming more fun in the ways that I think people are going to enjoy. It stars Kiernan Shipka from Mad Men and briefly Feud as Sabrina. And yeah, as I said, she her father was a powerful warlock. Her mother was a human, and so as a result, there's some question as to whether or not she is conscripted to becoming a witch and a Satanist herself. And when she does, there's a whole Academy of Witchcraft, which is a little bit like the Academy of the Supernatural on the CW's Legacies, only probably darker and better done. But there's a lot of talk, and she has to deal with her human friends who she would leave behind, and her human friends are very, very poorly developed, and they're not interesting. But on the other hand, her aunts are played by by the very, very good Miranda Otto and the frequently charming, but at least not initially, eventually she gets there, scene-stealing Lucy Davis. So there are good people, and Richard Coyle from Coupling, who is really an incredibly talented actor, plays the head of the coven that may or may not get Sabrina, and he is having some fun reading a lot of the satanic proclamations that he gets to read. It's not necessarily Coupling level funny, but he is an actor who is gifted giving delicious turns to dialogue, so he's fun. And I think in my review I suggested that ultimately the way a lot of it feels is kind of American Horror Story light, and I think there's an audience for that. I think that the younger the viewer, it might be too scary or disturbing for some very young viewers, like parents who are basically my age, or perhaps a few years younger, who grew up on Sabrina the Teenage Witch, yeah, the Melissa Joan Hart version. They might think, oh, this is a chance to introduce the property to my 8 or 9 year old.
Right.
And that is probably a mistake. Basically, in terms of the age that this is for, if your kids are too young for Riverdale, they are probably too young for this. On the other hand, if your kids love Riverdale, probably they will enjoy this quite a bit. Riverdale is, at this point, really kind of horrible and ludicrous, but lots of people still enjoy it for that. And I think that by the time this gets to the second half of the season, people will have fun with it. But tempering expectations is helpful.
Yeah. You know, when I saw the trailer for it, I was like, "This Sabrina?" Like, it was very off-putting and not at all what I expected, because, you know, like you said, everybody associates, or at least I do, associate that with the talking cat, Melissa Joan Hart, and that's not at all what is indicated in the trailer at all. So,
no, nor is it the freckled kind of saucy tight sweater wearing character from the comic. It is not, or from the original comic rather. It is not that. It, as with Archie, where they have characters talking about a drug called Jingle Jangle, and there was a mobster named Papa Poutine last season, and everyone has to take this stuff very seriously for it to work.
Yeah,
that is kind of the vein that the Thrilling Adventures of Sabrina, again, there's no the, God, I really can't get over that. It feels like there should be a the at the start of it, right, and there is not. But yes, a really wonderful animated opening credit sequence. Uh-huh. So if you're ever bored and just want to watch about 90 seconds of amusing, creepy animation and a really good opening credits theme, I strongly recommend the opening credits sequence to Chilling Adventures.
I got to tell you, I miss opening credits. And they barely exist anymore. I like a good TV theme song, and I like a good opening credits. So, but that's something that you don't see very often anymore.
Not much, and Netflix has the whole thing where they allow you to skip it
over,
as is. And so something like Haunting a Hill House, that's a really boring title sequence.
Yeah.
And some of the Marvel shows have had decent title sequences. I still watched the title sequence for Luke Cage all the way through each episode, but no, it's a lost art. It really is.
Yeah.
And I appreciate it anytime someone wants to actually give me a good title sequence, and this one is really top notch.
Cool. All right. The Alec Baldwin Show. I have not watched it. I would not watch the Kim Kardashian episode if you paid me. I missed the De Niro episode and Taraji P. Henson, but I am DVRing this Sunday because he's got two of my favorite people on the planet on, and that's Ricky Gervais and Jeff Bridges. It's two of my favorite people on the planet. And speaking of Jeff Bridges, Dan, are you one of the three people that have seen Bad Times at El Royale?
No, I am not. Is it good?
It's terrific. I highly recommend it. And no one's going to see it. And no one's going to see First Man either. Both of which I think are both really terrific films, and no one's seeing them.
Yeah, First Man is really good, and I saw that one. That one felt like it was urgent to see on a big screen.
Yes.
And I think it is. I think probably El Royale is one that has, to me, the feeling of an airplane movie at some point later in life or in a few months. You can tell me if I'm going to miss anything vastly cinematic about it, but it seems like a world I could get sucked into for 2 hours if I were an entirely captive audience, and I might enjoy it in that circumstance.
Yeah, it's 2 hours and 25 minutes, by the way, so you can...
Perfect. It's a long flight.
Yeah. Well, I think it's better than that. I think it's better than an in-flight movie. I think it's actually really great. And a lot of people are, complaining about it because it's Tarantino-esque, and that's certainly one of the things that is definitely about it. But I think Drew Goddard is a really clever writer and a good filmmaker, and I am such a massive fan of Cabin in the Woods, and I think everybody in the movie, especially Jeff Bridges, is great, and Chris Hemsworth is phenomenal in it. I just think it's terrific. But speaking of Jeff Bridges, he's going to be on the Alec Baldwin show on Sunday, and you watched the first episode, correct?
I watched the first episode, and like you, I did not watch the second episode, though I did watch a few highlights from the Kim Kardashian interview, or what they purported as highlights. They didn't really feel like highlights.
Right.
Or if those were what the highlights were, says what it is. Yeah, it's just bad and unnecessary, and I think my review was on the generous side in saying that it had a couple moments, and it's sort of, he was committed to whatever he is doing in the same way that he's committed to being host on Match Game, which he's very good at. The first couple interviews, basically he overcompensated for how Robert De Niro is not really a very good talk show guest.
Right.
I mean, he's kind of made a career out of being a professionally awkward talk show guest.
Sometimes
people get good stuff out of him as a result, but in terms of, would you ever want to watch an interesting late-night conversation with Robert De Niro? Well, yes, you would. You just never get one. Comparably, this is the interview with Alec Baldwin was not all that interesting. There were a couple little moments. Oddly, Robert De Niro was happy to talk about his career as a restaurateur. So he gave a really full answer talking about Nobu. And he was perfectly happy to talk about politics. And so he gave an answer about why he's been politically outspoken in the past couple of years. Not that there was really any question as to why he has been. And the Taraji P. Henson interview was mediocre, and that's too bad because she's like the opposite of Robert De Niro. She doesn't require an interviewer. You just press go and let Taraji P. Henson go, and she's fantastic almost always.
Yep.
And he had to kind of frequently interrupt her just to be present. And not literally no one is watching, but figuratively no one is watching.
Yeah.
It's about as low a rated show as you can find on broadcast television at this point. And if this were any other era of TV and TV ratings, it would have been canceled immediately and no subsequent episodes would have aired. Or they would air on a Saturday night where they can't do any harm. It's reflective of how strange TV ratings are in 2018 that it actually is going to air more episodes on Sundays.
I like Alec Baldwin and in many capacities, and it just didn't strike me as something I wanted to see. But considering that he's, like I said, on Sunday, he's got two of my favorite people on the planet on the show. So I'm going to tune in for the guests. That's also what I do with some of the late night shows that I'm not crazy about. Like when Jimmy Fallon has somebody good, I'll put up with him. And when James Corden has somebody good, I'll fast forward through everything except the interview portion with the guest I want to see. But I'm looking forward just to see these, Ricky Gervais and Jeff Bridges talk, because I love those guys. So.
Well, I hope he does better with them. I think that probably, I can't imagine either one is going to bring out the best in him, honestly. So maybe I'll be wrong.
Okay. All right, Dan, always a pleasure, man. And we've got a lot of TV to talk about in the next couple of weeks, obviously. And we will talk to you then. Everybody can follow you on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, FIEN. Dan, thanks again. We'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Always a pleasure, Nick.
All right, buddy. Take care. Dan Feinberg, everybody, TV critic. You can read him in The Hollywood Reporter. And again, follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, FIEN. We'll talk TV with him in a couple of weeks. Halloween stuff coming up right after we take this break on WGN.